Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Coming up, the man behind Humans of New York, the blog of street photos of random strangers.
But first, the head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is answering questions before Congress today, and there are plenty to be asked about how two Dallas nurses caring for the first patient diagnosed in the U.S. became sick themselves, and why the CDC let one of them travel on a plane with a slight fever. On the Today Show this morning, a fellow nurse at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital, Brianna Aguirre, said she threw a fit when nurses were given bodysuits to treat Thomas Eric Duncan, but their necks were exposed.
I just flat out asked several infectious disease nurses, I asked the CDC, why? Why would I be wearing two pairs of gloves, three pairs of booties, a plastic suit covering my entire body, and then leave my neck hanging out this much so that something can potentially go close to my mouth or nose? Why would that?
Well, today, officials at airports in Chicago, Atlanta, the Washington suburbs, and Newark, New Jersey, will start taking temperatures of passengers, something New York's JFK airport has been doing since Saturday. Dallas County commissioners may declare a local state of disaster caused by the Ebola virus. So lots for the CDC director, Tom Friedman, to be asked about. Juana Summers is congressional reporter for NPR. She's in Washington. Juana, the hearing getting underway. Yesterday, Republicans Pete Sessions of Texas, Tom Marino of Pennsylvania called on Friedman to resign. The committee chair, Tim Murphy of Pennsylvania, expected to say health officials made false assumptions about preparedness in Dallas. Do we know what Dr. Tom Friedman, is going to say in response?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. What we're hearing and seeing from his prepared remarks, and he has not yet delivered these in the committee, is that he's expected to say that he is confident that the public health care systems are able to prevent an Ebola outbreak in the United States. Friedman is expected to call this the biggest and most complex Ebola outbreak the world has ever faced. Of course, now he is not apologizing for things that happened in these cases, but he's really underscoring the seriousness of the situation and goes on to talk at length to members of Congress about the preparations and the protocols in place at the CDC to deal with this event, as well as the partnerships going on the world stage to help combat Ebola in places other than the United States.
Well, a lot of questions, I think, about the protocol. A doctor at Emory University Hospital in Atlanta, of course, they oversaw the care of the first two American Ebola patients, told the New York Times the earlier CDC guidelines on protective clothing were absolutely irresponsible and dead wrong. On Tuesday, the CDC issued stricter guidelines. These are closer to the full body suits that charities have been using in West Africa. But body suits, what else do you expect they'll be asked about?
There are going to be a lot of questions, and I think a lot of them are going to focus on funding. Does the CDC, does the NIH actually have enough money to take care of the threat of Ebola to keep Americans safe? Congressman Chris Murphy, who chairs the subcommittee, just said on the House floor, actually, to every federal agency involved, if you need more resources, you need to come to Congress and tell us that. So that's going to be a really big focus here. Also, communication will be a focus. You know, on one hand, you have government officials saying the United States is prepared. On the other hand, you see these two nurses in Dallas have had transmissions of Ebola. So lots of questions as to how to communicate, how are protocols actually being enacted?
Well, that idea of funding, that's already an issue out on the campaign trail. Democrats have been accusing Republicans of cutting funding to the CDC. Republicans accusing Democrats in the White House of dropping the ball on preparedness. And then there are conservatives like Laura Ingraham asking, where's John Boehner, a Speaker of the House? They think Congress should come back and vote on things like blocking flights from West Africa. Of course, most of Congress is out on the campaign trail. Do you expect the questioning today to be partisan?
I think that there is a delicate balancing act here. You mentioned John Boehner. The House Speaker has recently said the White House should consider banning travel from West African countries. If you look out on the campaign trail where most members of Congress are right now, you're hearing them talk about this in the terms that you said, making a political Ebola argument. However, there's a really delicate dance that you have to play. Neither Republicans or Democrats want to be seen as politicizing what has become really a public health crisis that's captivated the attention of so many Americans around the world. But we are hearing some rhetoric. There was a liberal outside group that just put up an ad that's got a limited circulation that's really talking about this issue and saying that Republican spending cuttings are resulting in deaths and a lack of preparedness for this Ebola crisis. So there are certainly some politics at play here. Of course, this is Washington.
Right. Well, we're hearing reports that the first nurse infected, Nina Pham, is being moved to Maryland. We'll continue to follow that story. But meanwhile, Dr. Daniel Varga, the chief clinical officer and senior vice president of Texas Health Resources, which owns the hospital she worked at, is expected to testify. Any thoughts on what the hospital might say briefly?
What we're hoping to hear from, we're expecting to hear from the hospital is they will apologize and say that the symptoms of the first Ebola patient were not correctly diagnosed. They will apologize for the error and initially say that mistakes were made. And that's something that I think will certainly revive a lot of debate on Capitol Hill as to how those mistakes were made and how they're not made in the future if there is, in fact, another case of Ebola in the United States.
And of course, there might be some voices saying, look, maybe people did well considering this is the first this has ever happened. Who knows? We will be listening in. Juana Summers, NPR's congressional reporter. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a step back from the news now to talk about people with someone who spends his life talking with and photographing strangers. Brandon Stanton is the man behind the wildly popular blog and Facebook page Humans of New York, which features street photographs of random strangers in New York City, often paired with a short snippet of an interview with the person in the photo. Stanton's work was published in a New York Times bestselling book, also called Humans of New York, and he's just out with a new children's book called Little Humans. Brandon Stanton, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
Well, you have now more than 10 million followers on Facebook and even more on Tumblr and on Twitter. People clearly are connecting with this. What do you think it is that they're responding to?
Well, Humans of New York, you know, just kind of give the quick catch up for people who don't follow, is something I've been doing for 4 years, and I've stopped over 10,000 people on the streets of New York City, and I take a photograph of them, and I learn a little bit about their lives. And, you know, these conversations that I have with people on the streets escalate very quickly. You know, within a matter of a few minutes, oftentimes we're talking about things that they might not have told their closest friends or, you know, their relatives or their family. You know, things about their biggest fears or their biggest weaknesses. And, you know, so beyond the photography or beyond any type of, you know, journalism or anything, I think what really draws people to the work is that kind of that intimacy, the intimacy with strangers. You know, I think there's a certain, you know, power to getting a very intimate glimpse into somebody's life who you might have just passed by on the street and not thought twice about.
But why do you think that they're willing to be so open with you if, as you say, they aren't even telling these things to their family members?
Well, you know, I must qualify that at first, that they're not always willing to be open to me, with me. You know, I was out there today before I came into this interview, and I'd say, you know, 8 out of 12 people turned me down. You know, normally it's less than that, but, you know, oftentimes people aren't willing to talk. But, you know, a lot of times when they do agree to have their photo taken and we get into a conversation, you know, I always say that it's the reason that it's so easy to talk to a stranger as opposed to somebody who you're really close to is that these people that we're close to, we have such long histories with. You know, there's such a backlog in an archive of judgments and experiences that we think we have the people that we're closest to kind of really pigeonholed. And so often the people that are the last to notice that we've changed and or we've evolved our thinking or we've become a new person are the people that are closest to us. Mm. Talking with a stranger, someone who knows nothing about you, someone who has no preconceived notions or judgments about you, makes it that much easier to be kind of candid about your thoughts and your experiences.
Well, what do you ask? I know that you have a rotation of questions that you like to ask people.
Right. Well, you know, what I'm always looking for is I'm looking for a story. I always say that I'm looking for something that this person has not told me out of the 10,000 people I've talked to. With each individual person I approach, I'm looking for something from them that I haven't heard from anybody else. And that's almost never a philosophy or an opinion. It's almost always a story. Because I say we all have similar philosophies or opinions, but none of us have the same story. And so I ask questions in an effort to learn a story. And a lot of times I find that the most pivotal stories in our lives or the most powerful stories in our lives tend to revolve around very strong emotions. If you kind of think about to what the strongest memories are in your mind, a lot of times this is a time you felt really afraid or really sad or really happy. So a lot of my first questions revolve around those emotions. You know, when was the happiest moment of your life? When was the saddest moment of your life? When did you feel angriest? What do you feel most guilty about? And then with the follow-up questions, I try to kind of flesh out these stories as much as possible.
It's interesting you talk about asking people for stories. I remember years ago, as a young radio reporter, I was doing a project sort of similar to this called Sonic IDs, where I would go and ask people to tell me anything that they wanted to talk about, they could talk to me about it. And one guy who was the former keeper of a church clock tower, and we were right near it, he said, you know, that's what I want to tell you about. And I said, well, it's almost 2 o'clock. Why don't we go up and record the bell going off? And we walked up there and he starts to remember. He goes back and he starts to remember in his head. This is the first time he's been there in a couple of years. And he says to me, the best line I have ever gotten on tape in radio, he says, I guess my ultimate reason for retiring is that I don't really care what time it is.
Oh, man, I love
Which
that.
Which was great. Yeah, but yeah. I see what you're saying. You can just ask people and they will tell you.
I'm always amazed. You know, I've done it so much, you know, because when I first had this idea and I started approaching people, I was so nervous to even ask them for their photograph, you know, not even mentioning asking them personal questions about themselves. I didn't even think a stranger would let another stranger take their photograph. And having done this 10,000 times now, there's almost an assumption on my part that when I approach somebody and I ask them for their photo, that very soon we're going to be talking about very intimate things. Hmm. And, you know, I'm working on this assumption so much that sometimes, you know, I have to take a step back and say, God, you know, I talked to 5 different people today that, you know, told me some of their biggest secrets and biggest vulnerabilities before I even knew their name, you know? And it's just... It's a very interesting process and kind of, I guess, a glimpse into psychology and how willing we are to connect with each other.
This is Here and Now, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with Brandon Stanton, the photographer behind the popular blog and best-selling book, Humans of New York. Stanton is recently back from a global tour with the United Nations, where he photographed and interviewed people in a dozen countries. And he's just published a book for kids called Little Humans. And Brandon, why do a children's book?
Well, you know, one of the most popular parts of the blog has always been, you know, the photographs of children. I guess, mastered the art of not appearing creepy and asking children for their photographs, which always involves only dealing with the adult at first. whenever I photograph a child, I fully talk to the parent before I even acknowledge the child. But then as soon as the parent gives me the permission, I only focus on the child and I get on the ground and I try to kind of enter their world for a little while. And so the result has been over the past 4 years, a collection of just hundreds of kids' portraits that have been, you know, one of the most bright spots of the blog and one of the most popular spots of the blog. But, you know, there's also some very kind of raw material on Humans of New York. It's very uncensored. And so the blog hasn't really been available to a young audience. So the idea was it would be great to kind of package up these photographs, these great portraits of kids in a way that young people can really connect to. And that was our effort with Little Humans.
What's one of your favorites in Little Humans? One of your favorite stories that some little kid told you?
Oh, man. As far as like my favorite thing that a kid has said, actually just happened a few days ago. I photographed this little kid, and I always say that my favorite people to interview are the people who are at the beginning and the ends of their lives because they have two alternate perspectives of the world, but neither of them are less profound. The children are coming from a point of innocence, and whereas in, you know, really old people are coming from a point of experience, and they both say profound things drawing from these two different viewpoints. And yesterday I photographed this little kid, and he was dressed like Batman, and I asked him what he wanted to be when he grew up, and he said he wanted to be a police officer. And I said, you know, what's going to be the best part about being a police officer? And he said, finding out who made the mistakes. Hmm. And I love that he used the word mistakes instead of crimes. Yeah. And then I asked him what the hardest part about being a police officer was going to be. And he said, figuring out which key unlocks the jail. And I just love that he used the word unlock. And so, you know, a lot of times just kids in their innocence can put a little twist on something that, you know, comes off as very profound and very charming.
How did you get into this? You lost your job as a bond trader in Chicago, but how did you go from that to this?
Right. Well, I mean, I had just a few weeks before losing my job, I had purchased a camera just to kind of relieve stress on the weekends because obviously things weren't going well. And, you know, little did I know that 3 weeks later I was going to be out of the job. And, you know, I knew that I enjoyed taking this camera downtown Chicago at the time on weekends and photographing. And so once I lost my jobs, I was a currency trader. And so, you know, I kind of looked back at the past 2 or 3 years of my life. And, you know, this whole time, and there were parts of it I enjoyed. It's not like it was black and white. But, you know, this whole time I had been thinking about money, trading money to make money. And my life had kind of been consumed by an effort to kind of delay gratification by making money first and then hopefully putting that money towards something I really wanted to do in the future. And I said, well, I'm going to skip that step and I'm just going to do something that I love for no thought of compensation, just because I loved it. And at the time, even though I'd only been doing it for 3 weeks, that was photography. And so I kind of decided to travel around for a few months and just do street photography. And through that kind of time off, quote unquote, the idea for Humans of New York developed. And then it kind of took on a life of its own.
We're talking with Brandon Stanton, the photographer behind Humans of New York, and you're listening to Here and Now. And Brandon, you've taken it on the road far from New York. You went to the Middle East. You did 12 countries in 60 days, most of them war-torn or poor. Iraq, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Ukraine, Mexico. What did you find there? And did you find things were very different in terms of photographing and talking to people than when you're home in New York?
Well, you know, each country, obviously, you know, there are 12 different countries, and each one obviously had its own culture and its kind of own set of problems, so they can't be compared as a whole to New York. But, you know, one thing that I found in, and this is kind of difficult to put into words, but one thing that I found in a lot of places is how constraining in places where you don't have an infrastructure and places where you don't have security or an economy that kind of allows everybody to have a place, you have people's lives are more consumed by their present circumstances to the exclusion of kind of hopes and aspirations. You know, I interviewed a lot of refugees while I was on a trip. These were people who had just recently been displaced by war. And, you know, I asked them the exact same questions. You know, what was the happiest moment of your life? You know, what was the saddest moment of your life? What are your dreams? What are your aspirations? What's your greatest accomplishment? Things like this that I asked the people all day long in New York. And what I realized is that with people who don't have security in their lives or don't have the means to put food on the table, the mind kind of blocks out access to these other spheres of existence, whether that be your hopes or your aspirations or even your memories. And, you know, that was kind of really eye-opening to me, especially as I kind of returned to New York and, you know, people got to talk about their relationship problems and the dynamic of their father putting too much pressure on them and kind of bringing into focus that these problems and these dramas, while they are important and they are, you know, very touching, are a luxury to have. And it's a luxury that we have because so much of our lives are already taken care of for us by the infrastructure that's in place here in America or in the Western world.
I'm going to ask you one question before you leave, Brandon, and that is, what's your happiest memory?
Well, you know, my it's, you know, they have to be connected with Humans of New York because, you know, Humans of New York has just been such an amazing ride for me. The absolute most honest answer was when I found out the book was a number one New York Times bestseller because it was something that I really wasn't expecting. It came out in the middle of the fall. And I had moved here, you know, with nothing and chased this kind of crazy idea of approaching people on the street. And it took almost a year, over a year, of doing this all day, every day, before it started gaining any traction at all. And so for that to happen 2 years later, for this book of photography that I barely got published, I barely got a book deal, to, you know, suddenly be the number one selling book in the country, it was just immediately kind of a flood of release of all of the kind of frustration and hard work and loneliness that, you know, kind of came out of chasing something crazy like this. And yeah, you know, I just kind of started crying in a parking lot and did that for a good hour. And that was the happiest moment of my life.
Brandon Stanton. He is the author of the new book, Little Humans, and he is the creator of Humans of New York. Brandon, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
And it is a tough question. Mm. What was the happiest memory? We've been asking on our Facebook page, facebook.com/hereandnowradio. Debbie writes, standing under the chuppah with the man who was about to become my husband. It was 2 weeks after my 40th birthday. I had suffered from depression earlier in my life and honestly thought I wouldn't live long enough to see either 40 or my own wedding. We would love to hear from you at our website, hereandnow.org. You can also see some of the photos that Brandon has taken.
They are astonishing. You should check them out. And your happiest moment, can you...
No, I'm saying it's a too tough of a question.
Hard.
I can't think
too
of
many.
What it would be. Hereandnow.org.
Robert a third, fair ball. Moustakas across. And 29 years of frustration has ended. The Royals are going to the World Series.
After the game, one Kansas City player said, "My mom's out of town and I'm having a keg party," in a dramatic four-game sweep of the Baltimore Orioles. The Kansas City Royals have become the American League champs and are on to the World Series for the first time since 1985. Joining us to talk October ball, here and now is a sports guy and host of the Slate.com podcast, The Gist, Mike Pesca. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
I'm still realizing that 1985 was almost 30 years ago. That doesn't seem possible. But the Royals in the series, they were so down at the All-Star break. What happened?
Yeah, well, the Royals are a confounding team, but I love how confounding they are. So first of all, they don't hit home runs. They were the worst in baseball in home runs. That's not good. Then, so you say, all right, maybe they get on base a lot. They were okay, but they didn't take any walks. They were the worst in walks. And somewhere around, not even the All-Star break, let's go a little bit past. They were 49-50 with 99 games played. I mean, so they were a team that had like an 8% chance of making the playoffs. But they really put it together. They were 40-23 after that. And what they can rely on, because they don't have the huge power arms, are just scintillating acts of athleticism and defense. They win with their feet. They win with their gloves. They run the bases. And they have put together, I think, the best highlight reel of fantastic catches that I've seen in the postseason in maybe those 25 years, ever since Cyndi Lauper was singing.
Well, is this what they call small ball? You know, this idea of these really low-scoring games. The Royals won both by 2-1. Is that what you mean by small ball?
Yeah, except in, you know, game one in that wild card game when they had to, you know, win 9-8 against the A's. But it is, I mean, so let's talk about the two runs. They came in the first inning and they did not get the ball out of the infield. They barely got the ball past second base, but it was an infield hit. It was a hit batsman. It was advancing on bad throws. Mm. All of a sudden they're up 2-0 and their starting pitching is great. Their bullpen is unbelievable. So then when they can dominate the seventh, eighth, and ninth innings with guys who just haven't been giving up runs, Wade Davis and Greg Holland and Kelvin Herrera, they have a huge advantage. And obviously, they're just walking on air and feeling no pain and confounding everyone who says baseball's about taking walks and hitting home runs.
Well, so that's the American League and Kansas City. Let's go to the National League. San Francisco Giants, St. Louis Cardinals series. The Giants out in front now, but the team split the first two games. Now the Giants have won the last two, so the series at 3-1. Can the Cardinals come back from that 3-1?
Sure, same set of teams. The Giants came back 3-1 to make the World Series not too long ago. So it's certainly possible. You know, the Giants have been there 3 out of the last 5 years. I do have to say, when you look at Kansas City and this head-scratching, exciting team that you could sit a non-baseball fan down in front of and say, look at these highlight reels, and you compare it to San Francisco and St. Louis, there's nothing wrong with those teams. But in fact, there's so nothing wrong that in terms of storylines, what sports writers are excited about, the Royals pop and these other two teams are reliable and they're very good teams, but they're not doing anything that is making you, you know, question everything about baseball. I would say what the Giants are doing is they're taking advantage of Cardinals' mistakes and they've gotten great starting pitching as well.
Well, one of the teams, the San Francisco Giants, St. Louis Cardinals, will be facing the Kansas City Royals. You're going to offend somebody, so let's just do it in the few seconds we have. Which team would you like to see go ahead with the Kansas City Royals?
Show me a show-me state finals, right? Let's have Kansas City against St. Louis.
Okay.
Let's keep it in the heartland.
Let's see. Mike Pesca, host of the podcast, The Gist at Slate.com, and our sports guy, too. Mike, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
The midterm elections are less than 3 weeks away, so anyone within range of a television has been bombarded with ads like this one.
As a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, she skipped a key hearing where a top official gave an early warning about a new terrorist group known as ISIS. Jean Shaheen, standing with Obama, not New Hampshire.
Republican Senate nominee Scott Brown's campaign criticizing the Democratic New Hampshire Senator Jean Shaheen on ISIS. In response, Shaheen's people accused Scott Brown of peddling politics of fear and pointed out she'd voted to support airstrikes against ISIS. ISIS and Ebola have crept into campaign ads. One or the other might be the so-called October surprise, the thing that can turn a race. Let's check in with NPR politics editor Charlie Mathesian. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Robin.
And start with Ebola. Here's an ad from Democratic Senator Mark Pryor of Arkansas criticizing his Republican opponent, the Congressman Tom Cotton.
The Ebola outbreak is worse than anybody
is, quote, vastly underestimated.
Tom Cotton voted against preparing America for pandemics like Ebola.
And Charlie, Cotton supporters and other Republicans are talking about skewed funding priorities. But is this a good idea in general? It just seemed to come out of nowhere in the last week or so.
Well, that's exactly what happened, Robin. The Ebola issue really came out of the blue. It was not on anyone's radar for most of the election cycle. And then all of a sudden, this is an issue that candidates on both sides of the aisle are forced to grapple with and talk about on the campaign trail and in their debates. And now we're beginning to see the first evidence of hard-hitting ads that attempt to place the blame on the opposition. Now, will that work? It's probably too early to tell right now. Certainly at the moment, there's no evidence that it's having a material effect on any particular race, but we haven't seen that many ads on it yet.
Well, and it's a tricky, tricky proposition because you could be seen as, you know, exploiting people's pain. I mentioned the Republicans' talking points. Here's Colorado Republican Representative Cory Gardner in a debate earlier this week talking about the CDC and, you know, what they spend their money on.
Jazzercise programs, massage therapy, and urban gardens. How about we use money responsibly to make sure that we are protecting the American people instead of spending it wastefully under this administration?
You know, here they're more of the Republican strategy and expanding it out to the Obama administration.
Right. Well, the Republican strategy here is twofold. First, Republicans need to weave the Ebola crisis and response into their broader campaign narrative about White House incompetence. And they also need to and are trying to push back against the idea that Republican fiscal austerity or the Republicans, House Republicans' interest in reducing the size of federal government is somehow responsible for a bungled or ineffective response to the outbreak.
Yeah. Well, and then there's always the, you know, how it plays out. I would think if Ebola, it's actually not an outbreak right now, right? The CDC officials say it hasn't risen to that yet. You know, a few cases, it does not make for them an outbreak. But if it becomes one in which many, many people are ill, a sitting administration will be to blame. But can it also take credit if it's nipped in the bud?
Right. I mean, that's the problem that Republicans face with these ads. And if the administration is perceived, at least in the polls by voters, as having effectively responded and done it in a quick and efficient way, then all of a sudden those ads become meaningless and just get lost in the noise of the campaign.
Yeah. We mentioned ISIS. Talk about that and other issues that you're seeing come up.
Well, of course, there are the hardy perennial issues that you see in every election cycle, but the rise of ISIS has led to this boomlet of foreign policy or national security-oriented ads this year, and typically you don't see that much of that during congressional campaign season. And some of these ISIS-oriented ads have been pretty edgy, including, in one example, the use of frames from one of the ISIS beheading videos. So that's pretty much on the edge. But there's one thing to keep in mind when it comes to some of these ads that we're seeing or hearing about. Very often they're produced simply for shock value or to gain attention for a flagging campaign. In other words, they don't really get that much widespread attention. There's no buy behind it. Mm-hmm. And this is because campaigns understand that these kinds of spots are catnip for the media, which will write about them, and they never really even have to spend much money to get them on the air.
Yeah. Let's talk about the ads in general. What's the worst so far, in your opinion?
Well, I would say one of the worst is there's a brutal ad that's just been released by Texas Democratic candidate for Governor Wendy Davis, and that's been called one of the nastiest ads you'll ever see. And it's drawn some unusually harsh criticism because it uses the video of an empty wheelchair to attack the wheelchair-bound Republican Attorney General Greg Abbott, who's running against Wendy Davis. And that's really captured the attention of lots of newspapers.
Greg Abbott was a runner. He was struck by a tree during a storm, paralyzed from the waist down. He's in a wheelchair. And so as you look at this empty wheelchair, here's a portion of the Wendy Davis ad.
A tree fell on Greg Abbott. He sued and got millions. Since then, he's spent his career working against other victims. Greg Abbott, he's not for you.
Boy, Charlie, I mean, you know, her critics are saying, as you said, too far. But others are saying, how do you get across? That is the point that she wants to make, which is that he's stopped other people from getting payouts.
Right. And while that ad is out there, it also underscores the precarious situation that Wendy Davis finds herself in. Oftentimes when a candidate is trailing the way Wendy Davis has and the polls aren't moving and it's getting late in the campaign, you resort to these sorts of Hail Mary passes, you know, campaign ads that are designed to shock, just simply to change the momentum of a campaign and to gain some attention.
Yeah, but which way might the momentum go? How about one of the best ads?
Okay, well, this one's easy for me, Robin. My favorite ad of the election cycle isn't from a congressional or even from a statewide race. Rather, it's from a candidate in a state legislative seat in Alabama named Darius Foster. When I first saw it, I found it to be really powerful and thought-provoking because it aims to challenge stereotypes, which is especially important in this candidate's case because he's a black Republican candidate running an uphill race in an Alabama district that is not Republican.
Yeah, I think we have a little bit of that ad from Darius Foster, again, talking about the questions that he's asked.
Since I've announced my campaign, people mostly ask me, how long have I been a Republican? Where do I live? What school did I attend? I suppose they're just trying to get to know me or put me in a box.
Yeah, that idea of putting him in a box. I think you have one more that we can listen to. Dr. Monica Webby.
Right. This is another great ad that got lots of attention this cycle. And Dr. Webby was involved in this competitive primary, but she produced an ad that really serves as rocket fuel for her campaign because it was so powerful. It was very much of a tearjerker of an ad about her work as a pediatric neurosurgeon. Now, typically, as soon as I hear the tinkling piano music, I tune it out immediately. But this one really strikes a chord because of the authenticity of the mother who speaks of what Dr. Webby did for her daughter.
She talks about being 21 weeks pregnant, having an ultrasound, and what her doctor did for her. We'll have it for you at hereandnow.org. Charlie Mattesian, politics editor at NPR, thank you as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Remember the sitcom The Wonder Years from the late 80s and early 90s? The show followed 12-year-old Kevin Arnold through his teenage years growing up in the suburbs in the 60s and 70s and was narrated by the character's older self.
1968, I was 12 years old. A lot happened that year. Denny McLane won 31 games, the Mod Squad hit the air, and I graduated from Hillcrest Elementary and entered junior high school. But we'll get to that.
The Wonder Years aired for 5 years and ended in 1993 and has just been released on DVD for the first time. Joining us now from Los Angeles is Fred Savage, who played Kevin Arnold. Fred Savage, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, why do you think that The Wonder Years was so popular?
You know, I have to tell you, it's still amazing to me how much people talk about the show, how much the show still means to people, that they watch it again and again, and they share it with their kids, and they watch it with their families. It's just people related to it. You know, people saw themselves in these characters. You know, we told stories that were specific to the characters on the show, but at the same time had a universality to them. They had a dad just like that, or they had an older brother who was so mean to them, or a sister who was kind of so ethereal that they wanted to kind of reach out and touch and spend more time with. And, you know, regardless of when you grew up or where you grew up or where you came from, you can see part of your own experience in the show.
And yet, when you watch it now, it feels so different than it did to me watching it back in the late 80s and early 90s. I'm looking back and going, gosh, things were so much simpler back then.
Oh, my gosh. I look at it completely differently. You know, when I was doing the show, I saw it through a kid's eyes. You know, I was going through those moments, you know, in life, just like all the other kids that were watching the show. And revisiting it now, it's a completely different experience. You know, thematically, I'm now relating to the adults. You know, I understand Norma's heartbreak when she sees Kevin ride away from her on the two-wheeler for the first time. And I totally can understand Jack's struggle of not letting the pressures and the stresses of work, you know, spill over into his home life. All these themes that, you know, eluded me when I was a kid now really ring true and resonate. So I think the show just has that much depth that you can revisit it, you know, decades later and see a whole new side to it.
Actually, I just want to take a listen to a little bit of the show. Here's a scene with you from one of the episodes.
She's not mad at you. She likes you. She's not sure if she likes you, liked you, but she likes you. When she first liked you, she liked you, liked you. Unless she just thought she liked you when she really just liked you. But she likes you.
I knew it. I'm a Debbie fan.
So, by the way, your voice sounds almost exactly the same, except much deeper now.
good. I mean, who hasn't had that conversation? You know, who hasn't passed a note, you know, check the box yes, check the box no? I think that there are these kind of rituals of childhood that everyone experiences. I think that we were really focused on what was important to, you know, 12, 13, 14, 15-year-olds. And I think there's a moment that kind of perfectly encapsulates that. Early on, there was a scene where the family was all watching the moon landing in the living room, and Kevin's in the kitchen debating whether or not he should call a girl that he really likes. And I think that the kids on the show, we were consumed with the things that kids are consumed with. We weren't thinking about the world really outside of our own experience, which is completely authentic to that time in your life.
How old were you when you first auditioned for this part, and did you think you would get it?
I was 11, I think, when we made the pilot. So I think it was 10 or maybe just 11 when I came to L.A. to read for the part with my dad. And we stayed here for a couple of days, and I loved, you know, we stayed in a hotel room. We drank out of the mini bar. We went and got like a seafood lunch, you know, right after the audition. Like, those are the things that I really remembered and took away with me. The trip to L.A. and spending time with my dad. I wasn't really focused on show business. You know, I mean, I enjoyed it and that's what I did, but it wasn't about winning or losing or getting a job or not getting a job. I just, all the experiences, just coming out to LA was fun for me.
But after a while, after doing this, and we hear about this in TV show after TV show of all of the backstage drama and people having a really hard time with dealing with the fame, especially kids who are actors. Did you have those problems?
You know, I'm very fortunate. You know, I have a great family and a great group of friends and a terrific support group who I did not feel like a celebrity. I did not feel like the star of a television show. I was a normal kid. You know, I went to regular school. I had regular friends. And when the show ended, I was able to kind of, I had a very full, rich life waiting for me.
We're talking with Fred Savage of The Wonder Years, which is now out on DVD, and you're listening to Here and Now. And Fred Savage, did you have a favorite episode of the show?
I did. I had a few. I mean, the first one and the last one, I love those. But there was an episode about, I think, the very first season where Kevin goes to work with his dad. And I just remember growing up how much I loved going to my dad's office with him. And I really related to that. That was just a great episode. And Dan was so fantastic in it. And that one really meant a lot to me. And there was another one later on where this math teacher that Kevin had grown really close to dies. And that really resonated with me. When that was being made, I was kind of dealing with my first real loss, you know, my first experience with the death of someone who meant so much to me. And that was kind of happening right as Kevin was dealing with that same thing. So that really stuck with me.
As I took that test, I thought about a lot of things. About how I knew him. And yet, I didn't. About how he treated me like a man. And how I'd acted like a child. About how I let him down. And now I wouldn't. The thing is, even though I could almost feel him in the room, I knew I didn't need him for the answers or the praise. I was on my own now.
A clip from The Wonder Years. We're talking with the show's star, Fred Savage. And you're now directing this show, The Goldbergs, which is sort of similar to The Wonder Years, about a family living in the suburbs, this one in the 80s. What are you drawing on from your experience on The Wonder Years that you can bring to The Goldbergs?
on any show that I'm directing, you draw on any host of experiences, you know, whether it's directly from the Wonder Years or it's something from my life or it's a show I've seen or a movie I saw or another episode that I shot years ago. Hopefully a director has a whole war chest to draw from for experience.
I mean, is there some trick that you learned while doing the Wonder Years that you just apply to your everyday work on the Goldbergs?
Oh, be on time and be prepared.
There we go. See, those are good for anybody, really.
Those are good for anybody. That's what I mean. Like, I feel like my experience as a child actor well prepared me for adulthood. That's for sure.
If there's somebody out there who has never seen this show, or you could say even if there's an alien that comes to this planet and wants to know about the Wonder Years, what would you tell them that it is? What is the definition of this program that so many of us know very well, but there are probably some people who never watched and don't know much about at all?
I mean, I think The Wonder Years is a show that looks back on all the indelible moments of growing up and looks back at them with laughter, with wisdom, with heartache, with all the emotional truth that living those experiences brought.
Fred Savage, actor from The Wonder Years, of course, and now a director working on other shows, including The Goldbergs. Fred Savage, thank you so much.
I really appreciate it. Thanks for talking to me.
What a pleasure to have.
I tell you, it was
Fred
so
Savage.
Inappropriate that I had a crush on him back then. It's probably even more so now. He's delightful.
With that, here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.